waves. Two speeches today. The first one known as the Uncommon Man. The Ruskies aren't celebrating the common man. No, the Ruskies are celebrating the uncommon man, as America ought to as well. Stay tuned. That's the first portion of Paul Harvey on this afternoon's Conservative Corner. Then we move along to side two. All men are not created equal. Once again, Paul Harvey, two speeches today on WFMU's The Conservative Corner. Please do stay tuned.
Hello, Americans. I'm Paul Harvey. Not all men are created equal. I know to explode that trite old equality theory is almost like defending sin or attacking motherhood, but the equality theory is false. And any society predicated on a false premise is predoomed. While Americans deify the so-called common man, the Russians are beginning to reward the uncommon one. Before it's too late, it's time this should be said. Not all men are created equal. You see, Mr. Lincoln's otherwise splendid Gettysburg Address came before IQ tests were invented. Believers in democracy just didn't know any better. Admiral H.G. Rickover, the godfather of the atom sub, says he thinks the greatest disappointment ever suffered by sincere believers in democracy was when they awakened one day to find out that the IQ of humans ranges from 0 to 200. We're that far from equal. Adman Charles Brower says we Americans are perpetually the victims of our own nonsense. We love to honor as truth anything that's palpably untrue as long as it's launched pompously enough and as long as it's been thoroughly aged. And he's talking about the oft-quoted remarks such as Abraham Lincoln's, all men are created equal. Mr. Lincoln himself was a splendid example of the fallacy of his own statement. Men are not created equal. They don't have the same coordination, the same respiration, the same fingerprints, the same pulse rate, the same IQ. You know this, I know this. Everybody knows it, and yet we run many of our institutions as if this sacred cliche were true. Now, the truth is that some people are built for leadership and some are not. The sooner we do something to encourage the leaders, the better for all of us. Carl Sandburg says he thinks President Lincoln might better be remembered for an anecdote he liked to tell about the Irishman who boasted, in this country, every man is as good as the next one. And for that matter, a little better. Now, it's not Mr. Lincoln's fault entirely. He lifted that line from our Declaration of Independence, but out of context. First sentence, second paragraph, but it goes on to specify equal rights. Life and liberty and so forth. You see, that declaration was intended to forestall anybody laying claim to power by virtue of having been born a king or a queen or a prince or some such. We recognize no such titles, but when our founding fathers got around to writing a constitution for our new nation, they specified in sentence 1, paragraph 3, section 2, that all men are not created equal, not even when it comes to counting population. Incidentally, it's interesting about that Declaration of Independence. The whole thing starts off when, in the course of human events, it becomes necessary for one people. You can stop reading right there. One people as opposed to all people. We, even as a nation, did not intend to be equal to others. We wanted to set ourselves apart, to be better, to do bigger things, and we, by George, did. The beginning of the spectacular American civilization involved the weeding out of the weaklings, the elimination of the unadaptable. From 1606 until 1624, 5,000 people migrated from England to the vicinity of Jamestown. Only 1,200 of them survived. And yet early hardship bred a batch of men of such creativity and capability as this world has never seen in such numbers before or since. Epitomized by one of the most unequal men who ever lived, Benjamin Franklin. He, in paragraph 3, section 2, that all men are not created equal, not even when it comes to counting population. Rod, and discovered the cooling effect of evaporation, and he charted the Gulf Stream, and he invented bifocal glasses, and all this in his spare time. When Christ was on earth, he recognized the inequality of men by reciting the parable of the talents. We have different talents. We're not equal. Look at the members of your own family. Each demonstrates different aptitudes. Environment and heredity have been similar, if not identical, and yet some individuals within the same family are better able to solve problems. Gradually, some educators are recognizing that we should encourage the difference and not discourage it. Toynbee says, growing civilizations differ from static, primitive societies in virtue of creative individual personalities. Now, we're in a life and death east-west struggle for survival. We can't afford to be static. The improvement of quality in people, Toynbee taught, required the elimination of weaklings. Let's wait a minute here. You and I are not willing to force the weak to work or turn them out to die. Neither, however, should we ever weaken the strong by discriminating against excellence. Recently, the office seeker has so often solicited support by labeling himself a common man. Why should anybody aspire to be a common man, an average man? Do you realize what it means to be average? That means you're the best of the lousiest. And the lousiest of the best. For that matter, chemists who used to analyze the worth of a man by measuring his components estimated his market value at $19.16. Today, in an inflated market, they say a man's worth $32.44. So if you really believe in the equality theory, sell out for that price, because if we might allow a somewhat grisly observation, your buried carcass is worth less than a dollar as fertilizer. Thus we see that it is the output of that pile of potash which makes a man a man. And as men, we're decidedly unequal. Of course, the door to opportunity is not opened by an electric eye. Thus it is that many persons with much talent are, as was the hare but the tortoise, overtaken by persons of lesser ability but greater perseverance. Often, in fact, the person who can do many things well fails to concentrate his efforts in any one direction, thus yielding success to the person who is gifted in only one direction, but moves steadily in that direction. So the race is not always to the swift. What the world calls success is not always to the highest IQ. But that's the way to bet. You know, one factor I think almost essential to success is health. Now again, some have succeeded despite physical handicaps, some doubtless inspired by them. But these exceptions notwithstanding, the energy necessary to scale the heights, the energy necessary to climb requires a strong, healthy, better than equal physique. Medicine is learning more and more that men are not created equal, not even in their susceptibility toward, nor in their tolerance for disease. Certainly, we are unequal in athletic prowess and in artistic ability. With each generation revealing some spectacular individual improvement over the generation which preceded it, yet not all of us in any generation, whatever our training, could sing like Leontine Price, or high jump 6 feet, or run a mile in 4 minutes. Pope John said it, absolute equality is not possible because the Lord did not make us all equal, end quote. Now, the Pope and Billy Graham will insist that we are all equal in the eyes of God, and yet each of these men is himself a spectacular example of how unequal we are in the eyes of men. Genghis Khan was a nomad, a nothing. He came riding out of the Gobi Desert with his wild riders and conquered most of the known world. He had been a herder of beasts, nothing more. And yet he outgeneraled the armies of 3 empires. He could not read, he could not write, and yet he drew up a code of laws for 50 nations. So don't you underestimate today's dictators either. They too are uncommon men. And each of such comes out of the desert every so often in history like a scourge to destroy civilizations which are decadent and fat and indulgent and lazy and rotten and ripe for destruction. Lord Byron says civilization goes like this. First you have freedom, and then glory, and then wealth, and then vice, and then corruption, and then barbarism. Voltaire said it this way: history is only the patter of silken slippers descending the stairs, and the thunder of hub-nailed boots coming up. Now we come to the point of this. Hitler and others discovered the hard way that there is no super people, there is no super race of people, but certainly there are superior individuals, sometimes inspired to greatness by circumstances, but almost always with a head start. And there are the others, the weak, who will always need to be assisted by the strong. The poor, the Bible says, we'll always have with us. Some will always need to be cared for by others. But weakness and dependency must never be our objective. We must, as our self-reliant granddaddies did, encourage a spirit of independence. We must seek after self-sufficiency, even though a percentage of persons will always fall short of that goal. The liberals who would subsidize everybody are just as wrong as the conservatives who would assist nobody, and that's where both our political parties ought to come to grips with the question of how much is too much government. Now, as we say in my Missouri Ozarks, let's shuck right down to the cob. What about the color of a man's skin? Much past and present ferment in the world reflects a race conflict. Previously subjugated races insist they want equality. Don't you see there is no such thing? They might rightly and properly strive for and demand equality of opportunity. There's an important difference, but neither government nor society can enforce equality. Nor indeed should they. The trees of the forest are not equal. It's each striving toward a place in the sun that makes all grow tall or die. Americans, let's cut out the hypocrisy in this whole thing. We recognize the importance of patient, tedious, year after year, generation after generation, breeding to bring out the best in our racehorses and our beef herds and our milk cows and even our pet dogs. Are we to treat the human race with such indifference as to shrug and proclaim, they're all equal? We've said it so often we came to believe it, and then when there's unrest in the Belgian Congo, we urge the Belgians to get out of there and allow those Congolese self-rule. Because generations of American Negroes have come to produce the likes of a Ralph Bunch, we assume anybody can, and not everybody can. We figure the whole world is now ready for self-government, and it's not. Civilization at its most accelerated pace is agonizingly gradual. Now, if there is one controllable common denominator which separates from the rest those men whom the world calls successful, I think it's this: they get up when they fall down. But I say to you that there's no power on earth which can keep a first-class man down or hold a fourth-class man up. The strength of democracy is not in the equality of men. It's in the fearless pursuit of truth by the minds of men who are free to be unequal. The yardstick by which Congress ought to measure its intentions is this: government should not be first aid, but a last resort. Government should do for people that which must be done for them and which they cannot do for themselves, and only that. Never first aid, but a last resort. One of the negative side effects of this equality theory is manifest in our increased juvenile delinquency. Constantly using the common man as our template, young folks have found American democracy to be immensely dull. What do you and I have to look forward to anyway? Think about it. We're going to live, what, 3 score, maybe 4 score, a few more or less years, then probably in pain we will die and our earthly remains decay away, and that's as sure as taxes. If that's all there were to this earthly pilgrimage, we'd be justified in getting in line for the high windows just to get it over with. A man has to have a reason to live and a reason to die. And make no mistake about it, communism gives a man that reason. We'd like to spoof ourselves that the Reds were able to attack in wave after suicide wave just because there are bayonets at their backs, but that's not wholly so. They are so hopped up on this godless substitute for religion that they're convinced in their hearts that this is the way to make the world a better place for themselves, failing that for their children, that death is a cheap price to pay for such progress. Now, with what kind of an affirmative faith of our own are we going to counter this fraudulent religion which is so fast engulfing the world in darkness? We need a reason for being what we are, even as a boy needs a chance to prove himself a man. This one for all for one equality, punish the strong to prosper the weak, persistent applause for the person who sticks with the pack, castigation for the one who dares to stand up and go it alone, youngsters will rebel out of sheer boredom. They'll steal cars or sample narcotics just for kicks. The American dream, which intended to allow each man to outreach the other in his quest for a place in the sun, caused each to grow tall and ultimately prospered us all. Now, if we demand more and more for producing less and less, while the have-not nations encourage and inspire and indeed require hard work and maximum effort, if we deify the common men while they encourage and reward the uncommon ones, well, the end result of such a lopsided race as that is too obvious to require elaboration. Americans, there's much to do. We can't do everything at once. But we can do something at once. Now, let's talk about that on side two.
Now, I want you to think and stop being a smart aleck. Can you try that for me? There's sometimes a buggy. How many drivers does a buggy have? So let's just say I'm driving this buggy, and if you fix your attitude, you can ride along with me. Man's attitude goes some ways, the way his life will be. Is that something you might agree with? Now, did you answer because that's what you thought I wanted to hear? Or did you think about what I said and answer because you truly believe that to be right? What'd I say? Well, now, here's a man who wants to get right down to it. Kind of anxious to get to it, are you? And you will see me one more time if you do good. You'll see me two more times if you do bad.
As most of you realize, political correctness has gone off the chart here in America, and here's another example. The Krispy Kreme Donut Company in Palm Beach, Florida, offered to give students who earn good grades donuts as a reward. For each A, they get a donut. But no, school board member Deborah Robinson doesn't like that, because donuts may lead to obesity. Well, I say it's better to be chunky than dumb, Ms. Robinson. Wise up, and let the kids earn a treat. To not do so would be ridiculous. I do eat Krispy Kreme, and I'm not obese. Time now for another most ridiculous item of the day. Howard Dean told a group in Washington, D.C. that cable news was responsible for his demise because he wasn't really screaming when he was screaming. He was just trying to make himself heard in a big crowd. Okay, then. It's just another example of how the far left is spinning things out of control these days. The latest thing, vis-a-vis the factor, is to take things that we say facetiously and quote them as serious. I do 3 hours of commentary every day, an hour here, two on the radio, so it's a pretty easy and sleazy thing to do. Last week we showed you how Michael Moore took a joke and turned it into an accusation in Playboy magazine. And now to other lefty bomb throwers have done the same thing on the net. They're looking for publicity. I'm not playing. I would like, however, to thank the Toronto Star for correcting, on the record, Mr. Moore's remarks. I appreciate that newspaper's honesty, and honesty is never ridiculous. Writing in the New York Times today, the very biased Alessandra Stanley says, FNC has relished the controversy, seizing hungrily on the charges against Kerry. That's, of course, about the Swift boat deal. Now, Ms. Stanley neglects to tell her readers that Chris Wallace and I spent 6 minutes getting the record straight last night, and we could not, I repeat, could not have been more fair to Senator Kerry. Now, here's a personal message from me to you, Ms. Stanley. Knock it off. Evaluate what we do here fairly, all right, madam? Get a transcript of last night's factor and publish it so your readers will know the truth. Your blatant bias against Fox News is ridiculous and belongs on one of those bomb-throwing websites, not in a national newspaper. And now it's back to school time. When I was a little kid, I hated this season, but now many kids love school. And one of the hot items this year is a notebook which says, I love everybody except you pinheads. Everybody's using our phrases here. We got Travis Tritt. We've got this bunny. Well, while we can't argue with that quotation, we can advise kids to be careful about labeling anyone a pinhead unless they really, really deserve it. To use the expression, excessively would be ridiculous, unless you're me. It used to be that some Olympic women athletes would wait until after they actually won a medal before cashing in, but not now. In this month's Playboy magazine, Olympic uniforms were shed and skin exposed by some of the ladies. Now, we have nothing against the human body, but believe there may be some issues with chafing should medals be draped over undraped figures. Ridiculous? You be the judge.
Americans, we worry about the wrong things, you know. Example. Imagine the world without Khrushchev. Be honest now. Be as objective as you can. If the Soviet threat did not exist, would free men then perpetuate peace, prosperity, progress? We would not. The symptoms of internal decay are apparent today despite the circling scavengers licking their lips. While the communists move in 90 miles from Florida, we twist. Khrushchev has declared economic war. He boasts that Russia, producing 8-9% more each year, will overtake and then take over the United States in an economic race. Yet New York electricians struck 4 and got a 5-hour day and a 10% raise. Suppose there were no Soviet bomb dangling over our heads, no communist plan for economic conquest of the West to prod us. Would we then be content to keep hoeing in our own garden, or would we put aside the hoe and let the weeds take over? I suggest we would let the weeds take over. We are 17 cents away from a 2-bit buck, and yet we continue to demand more rotting dollars, more leisure, longer coffee breaks, less work. Khrushchev decrees no more retirement for able-bodied elderly Soviet citizens. They will keep working. While almost every politician and labor leader in the United States is promising you more pay for less work, earlier retirement, Russia decrees no loafing, no loafing, even if the alternative is a slave labor camp. Washington decrees increased handouts for welfare parasites. What I'm saying is this. The decay, which destroyed Rome and Spain and Greece and China, is apparent and apparently malignant in the United States. Even with the Russians chasing us, we tend to laziness, sloth, intemperance. If they were not chasing us, it is entirely likely that our accent on leisure, our corruption of politicians and police, our dependence on alcohol, narcotics, tranquilizers, divorce courts, and mental hospitals would be even greater than it is. Somewhere in the subconscious of most Americans is the awareness that we'll work willingly, or we'll work eventually under a whip. Now let's stop blaming the communists for what ails us. Perhaps it is communism's threat more than any other factor which is keeping us more or less awake. Of course, what we need to be is alert. If we get scared enough, there may be some hope we'll get off this something-for-nothing kick and get back to work. Americans of this generation may then live to enjoy such fruits of their labors as none has ever seen before. And if we do, perhaps we'll have the red jackals to thank. But if we don't, we'll have only ourselves to blame. And the time may be short. So many stand to lose so much, let's give a little thought to the care and feeding of the American ism. If I could shake the shoulders of every youngster today and command his concentration on one thing I'd have to say, if I could have 5 minutes with every student, every young man or woman his first day on a new job, if I could burn one message into the consciousness of all whose minds are not yet closed, whose consciences are not yet calloused with cynicism, it's this. Nowadays you can do such big things with such little effort. When some of us were growing up with a generation running scared from a terrible depression, there was keen competition for every opportunity. Everybody was ambitious, tried harder, worked more, loafed less, reached higher. Each of us bucked a strong headwind. Today you get big league wages for playing bush league ball. 19-year-old comes into my office today seeking his first employment, and his first question is about retirement benefits. Now, it's not just in our country. In London recently, five men were caught in the act of stealing 1,500 cartons of milk from a truck. And a passerby became suspicious and called police and asked later why he became suspicious that these five men unloading the milk were crooks. The witness said, "You never see an honest man work that fast anymore." Great industries wrestle in vain with such problems as how to find a polite receptionist, or a cheerful telephone operator, or an enthusiastic salesman, and when one is found, he or she is so quickly promoted the vacancy is never filled. You young folks who are willing to give out with such a little extra effort can climb so far, so fast, the height'll make you dizzy, but with no sweat, never were Americans able to get so much mileage on so little gas. No, you'll be a target, of course, when you distinguish yourself. You always find the most clubs under the tree with the best apples on it. It won't be all fun or all easy. If you'll not suffer the headwind which my generation encountered, you'll nonetheless find yourself dragging along a lot of dead weight. There are always the gold bricks and the deadbeats in every office, shop, or factory. The little foxes always yapping at the heels of an eager beaver. I think sometimes Satan is never more in our midst than when he masquerades as a worker but does not work. His are the idle hands which never answer the phone on the first ring. He's the one who says, when you come back from lunch 5 minutes early, "What's the matter, Mac? Trying to make the rest of us look bad?" He chides you for overworking or overtime. 20 years ago, he'd have been fired in the first half hour. This pipsqueak is your internal insecurity. He is the dry rot that threatens to sink our ship of state. Not the lousy communist, but the lazy American.
God reigns, and the government in Washington still lives.
In recent days, there's been a good deal of discussion about who bears the responsibility for the terrible activities that took place at Abu Ghraib prison.
These people had a job to do, but they were taking pleasure in it. There's something psychologically wrong with that. It's not the act so much. It was like a college fraternity prank to stack up naked
Exactly my point. This is no different than what happens at the Skull and Bones initiation, and we're going to ruin people's lives over it, and we're going to hamper our military effort, and then we are going to really hammer them because they had a good time. You know, these people are being fired at every day. I'm talking about people having a good time. These people, you ever heard of emotional release? You ever heard of need to blow some steam off? These people are the enemy.
God reigns, and the government in Washington still lives.
Janet Jackson has now apologized for the incident in which one of her breasts was bared for a moment when she was singing with Justin Timberlake. In a statement she released late last night, she said it was a last-minute stunt that didn't work out right. The decision to have a costume reveal at the end of my halftime show performance was made after final rehearsals. MTV was completely unaware of it. It is not my intention that it go as far as I did. I apologize to anyone offended, including the audience, MTV, CBS, and the NFL. She went on to say. And of course, Howard Dean had to weigh in. After all, he is a presidential candidate. And he says that he dismissed as silly the government inquiry into whether indecency rules were. But, you know, there's nothing silly about it. Parents have the right to turn on their television sets, the people own the airwaves, and not worry about it the next moment if these guys are going to be bumping, grinding, pounding, spanking, and exposing. You know, if they want to let it, you know, free reign like that, then fine, just let us know so that we can cancel all our subscriptions to cable and cancel our subscriptions and get our TVs out of our house, and we'll just all work on, you know, or come up with some software that we only put on channels that promise not to do it. That, I mean, that's all we want. We'd like to raise our kids in the comfort of our home without being inundated every single solitary second. That's it. It's really that simple. And if people want to go down this road, then there are going to be alternative choices made available to parents with technological advancements, and we will have the ability to make the choices we deem that are right. And it's all part of a bigger societal decline anyway, which is what all that we discussed yesterday, and I don't really feel the need to repeat myself. I mean, does anyone really think it's somehow society benefits from any of the music you hear, be it heavy metal or rap or any of this garbage? I look at the average person. Sweet Baby James, remember the other day we were driving and we were pulled up next to this girl and the girl was and the car is vibrating and my car next to it is vibrating. Now, first of all, I've lost some hearing because of the headphones that I wear over the years. Now, nothing serious, just, you know, just little nerve damage stuff. And I'm thinking, what an idiot. And I said, Sweet Baby James, roll down the mirror. And I, you know, I'm like saying, hey, man, can you, like, put that up? It's really cool. I just can't hear it. And what does the person do? Sure, I'll put it up, dude. It's, you know, look, think back of the music we used to think was cool when we were young. Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven, a real profound song, isn't it? Whole Lot of Love. Oh, yeah, we're getting a lot. You know, it's like you're embarrassed at some of the music that you used to think was so cool and hip. These kids are going to grow up, and they're going to look back at the fact that they like P. Diddy and Nelly the Crotch Grabber and the rest of these guys. This is stupid. It's idiotic. That's what's going to happen. But I got to tell you, between everything else, society, we don't raise people's consciousness anymore. I mean, there is, you know, people are craving some truth in their lives. I'm telling you, people need it. They're craving it. They're not even getting it in most churches anymore because churches are so darn politically correct. But there is, I mean, look at all the conflict and suffering out there. Isn't it bizarre? Why do so many, I was watching a report on one of the news channels this morning about how kids, no, I was watching it on ABC, Good Morning America. And they do, I think they did a report on Prozac for kids and all these drugs for kids. Dr. Timothy Johnson was on with Diane Sawyer. And I'm watching this, why are our kids depressed? And don't start with it's all chemically induced stuff because I'm going to burst a blood vessel and I'm going to need Prozac. I'm going to be depressed. No, it's, you know, we have everything. Everything's working out well, and we have more opportunity, more hope. You know, when I think of my parents' generation, my grandparents, they didn't have the luxury to be depressed and sit around. It's like if they heard all this today, they'd be bouncing their heads all against the wall getting depressed. It's ridiculous. You know, we're not happy. We drink ourselves silly. We drug ourselves numb. We gamble ourselves, sex ourselves. And it's like people aren't happy. All of this outside stimulation is not filling up an area in one's soul that makes people happy. Otherwise, people wouldn't be so miserable. They wouldn't need sleep medicine, happy pills, anxiety-free pills, whatever else everyone's taking. Everybody, I mean, we are a dysfunctional society in large part because we have lost contact with a certain element of the human psyche known as a soul and a conscience. And that is clearly not being appealed to by the pop culture, by the mainstream culture. We have souls, ladies and gentlemen. We have an innate ability to sense right and wrong. And when we go against that incredible innate silent voice of conscience, there will be conflict in people's souls. And there's going to be a need to sort of stop the burning of that conflict, and hence people seek outside sources of stimulation and happiness. But it will never, ever duplicate or replicate or fill the need of the real thing. And that is something there's no psychiatrist or psychologist that can, I don't know. I'm telling you, isn't that true? It's absolutely true. You want to be happy? Well, start listening to that little quiet voice within you. You know, but everything is geared towards the bump and grind. Everything is geared towards more sexuality at younger ages. Everything is geared to pull people away from that inner voice within themselves. And if you don't live that way, you're considered odd, peculiar, strange, bizarre in the real world. And I don't know where this rant came from. It just came.
Use diplomacy with the likes of him and keep on keeping on, and I tell you, if you can, there's never been an hour in modern history when an ordinary man with such a little extraordinary effort could catapult himself so far so fast. Never have we run such big things on such little batteries. Never has so little investment paid so much interest. Never has it been so easy to go from chore man to foreman. Such a little diligence, such a little discipline, such a little pleasantness, such a little determination, such a little enthusiasm is all it takes to distinguish an uncommon man, an exceptional woman, and the rewards, tangible and intangible, have never been more generous. Ambition is in such short supply today that a little goes a very long way. Now, the winning coach is one with an implacable hatred for defeat. And the successful man is one with complete contempt for waste. Now, the day we're willing to settle for a little defeat or a little waste, we're backsliding, and there aren't going to be any prizes for second best. In fact, if we lose this Cold War, you're going to wish with all your heart it had been a hot one. I think maybe the most productive tenant of the barnyard could teach us something about the worthwhileness of work, the hen. The hen digs worms and lays eggs. And regardless of what the slip, stick, swivel chair economists say about the... Did you ever hear Bernie Baruch's definition of an economist? Mr. Baruch says an economist is a feller who thinks he knows more about money than us as has it. But regardless of what the Wall Street Journal says, the hen keeps right on digging and consuming and producing. Whatever the business prognosticators prognosticate, the hen delivers 4 a week and tries for 6. If the ground is hard, she scratches harder. If it's dry, she digs deeper. If it's wet, she digs where it's dry. If she strikes a rock, she digs around it. If she gets a few more hours daylight, she digs a few hours longer, lays a few eggs more. She digs up worms, turns the worms into hard-shelled profits. Sometimes she sweats over those profits until they hatch a capital gain. But you never saw and you never will see a pessimistic hen. And you'll never see a hen starving to death waiting for the worms to dig themselves out of the ground. And you never hear a hen cackle because her work is hard. Never. She saves her breath for digging. She cackles when there's eggs. But you take that hen out of the barn lot and hopper feed her in a cage with nothing to scratch for anymore, and you'll get soft meat and few eggs. Now, Americans came furthest, fastest, when they scratched the mostest. If we are too lazy to scratch anymore, if we refuse to forage and demand to be pen-fed, if we elect to sit in the shade and demand that a union take care of us, or that our employer take care of us, or that government take care of us, whether we scratch or not, then the symptoms are familiar and the buzzards are circling. You see, the question is not whether Americans will get off their dead centers and get back to work. Either we will get to work, or the Russians will put us to work. It's that simple. Being a free man is worth dying for, but being a free man takes working at. Hats off to the past. Coats off to the future. Let's get scratching and get back in the lead where we belong. Americans, you know something. A lot of brides and grooms answer "I do" when they hadn't really heard the question. Young folks, and some not so young, recite the marriage vows without paying attention to what they're saying. It's rather like a prayer that becomes a recitation and loses its meaning. Take the words in sickness and in health. Why in the world does the vow specify both? It would seem that for a person to promise to be faithful when there's sickness would be enough. But maturity and experience teaches us that that's easy. It is more difficult to remain loyal and devoted in health, where other distractions and temptations are more likely to intervene. Take the phrase, for richer or poorer. That, too, would seem unnecessarily redundant. It seems superfluous to require that a person promise to live up to the marriage partnership when everything's going well. When things are rough, when we're poor, hard times, yes, then a man or woman should be required to stick with his bargain. But richer? Why, naturally, one might assume any marriage bargain would be certain to succeed if, as the songwriter says, I had plenty of money and you. But it's not necessarily true. You happen to know the source of the marriage vows? Very few do. Actually, the present wording of that marriage contract is not prescribed or specified by Holy Writ. It's nowhere to be found in the Bible. The framework for the words dates back to the primitive Sarum England Rite of 1078, but actually the formula just kind of evolved out of centuries of trial and error. Its workability is based on the experience of many generations, on honesty as much as morality. It's like the Holy Bible. If it were not holy, it would still be the best rule book for an orderly existence. If it were not divinely inspired, if it did not promise life hereafter, it would still be the best blueprint for a good life here. And so with the marriage vows, we have learned that this code for human conduct is best. And where it says for richer or poorer, we recognize that either is a strain on the tie that binds. Every day we're confronted with examples of marriages which can survive and thrive in poverty, yet they flounder and fall apart in prosperity. The sweepstakes winner, a happy workaday fellow, until riches wreck his life. The Dizzy Lucy duo, such a happy marriage that a multi-$1 million industry is built around it. Then the industry becomes a Frankenstein monster which smashes the marriage. It is true, it seems, of men and of nations, like the children of Israel who took 40 years of hunger and privation and hardship, but they couldn't take it easy. And so in their promised land of lush fruit and fat cattle and prospering flocks of sheep and milk and honey, they turned to evil and were consumed by it. You know what I'd like to hear the clergyman say? I think he ought to say, dearly beloved, I don't think you know what you're getting into. So before I ask for your solemn promise, I'm going to tell you something. When I get to that part about in sickness and in health, I mean what I say. You're stuck. That means when you're 50 and suddenly feel like a young colt, you don't jump the fence. And when I say for richer or poorer, don't you say you do, unless you mean to continue to love and honor and cherish, even if you strike it rich. Now, if you're sure you know what the vows say, and if you're prepared to resist when health or riches tend to lure you astray, let's get on with the ceremony. You see, love is a living thing. A living thing. That means it grows or it dies. In the beginning, romance, boy and girl, man and woman, the breathless ecstasy of infatuation, honeymoon, the excitement of exploration and discovery. Then, as with all growing things, one day the bloom is wilted. The seeds have fallen from the pod to propagate anew. And in the less than thrilling middle years, there is a time when married folks just kind of tolerate one another. Finally, later, this comes much later than most realize, love sets in. Real, whole, complete love in the third degree. Now, unfortunately, in that sometimes uncomfortable in-between time, uncomfortable mostly because it's his own waning virility which a man despises, and for a woman, her wrinkles. During this period, some fly the coop, jump the fence, seek to recycle their lives, get back to the beginning, rediscover romance. But don't you see, in starting over, they're delaying the ultimate fulfillment, because full-grown love requires many seasons.
syndicated columnist Art Buchwald's been around for a long time. He's still working at age 80. In his column of August 10th, Buchwald opines, "The conservative cardinal of the right-wing church is Bill O'Reilly of Fox News. O'Reilly says America is safer and better off now than before we invaded Iraq. Well, not quite, Art. What I did write on February 11th of this year is, I still support the removal of Saddam Hussein because the world is a safer place and terrorists have lost much opportunity in the Middle East. Because, of course, Saddam is not there to support those terrorists. So, Art, you know, come on, all right? I wrote that in a column. All you had to do was read the words. Buchwald's ridiculous. He should know better. He does it on purpose, and I'd be happy to debate him any time, and he doesn't even have to kiss my ring. The Cardinal of Conservative." Our pal Sharon Stone, well, that might be wishful thinking, is mad at President Bush, and here's why. Speaking to a website in Ireland, Ms. Stone claims that she was prevented from filming a lesbian scene in the movie Catwoman with Halle Berry because the current conservative climate in the country just wouldn't allow it. Ms. Stone went on to say that Halle's so beautiful, I just wanted to kiss her. That's what you get for having George Bush as president. So let me get this straight. President Bush stops Sharon Stone from cavorting with Halle Berry? I am outraged. This could be ridiculous. And finally today, our pals over at the ACLU have a Conan drum on their hands. If the group signs a certification stating it will not employ people who appear on federal terror watch lists, it could get $1 million in federal charitable donations. But if the ACLU refuses to sign, no cash. Since the ACLU is against any profiling of suspected terrorists, a ridiculous position on its own, it looks like they will pass on the money, which may be better spent elsewhere. If you get my drift.
Love evolves. It is somewhat the same with the love of a man for his home. To a boy, the hometown is filled with excitement and exploration and discovery. To the young man, far horizons beckon. But the old man, if he is still seeking far horizons, is a piteous person, uprooted, chasing every place, loving no place. On the other hand, you know, some of the happiest people I've ever known either returned soon to their hometowns or tolerated their hometowns through the long, dull years when restlessness might have lured them elsewhere. Finally, they developed a fierce pride in their home or their adopted community, a determined, protective, permanent love in the third degree. Perhaps with nations, too, this evolution can neither be hurried nor denied. The revolution is filled with fever and fire and excitement, but once this is spent, the nation becomes complacent and crotchety, self-critical. In our United States, with the honeymoon behind us and love in the third degree yet unrealized, we are inclined, aren't we, to carp and criticize and condemn and blame the government and even flirt with other kinds. I hope we don't jump the fence seeking greener pastures in our middle years, for this, with nations as with men, is merely to start all over again. The United States of America may not survive. The United States of America may not survive, but there is something more important than that. I don't believe Almighty God is going to preserve this promised land any more than he preserved the previous ones if its people are determined to destroy it. Nations are used of God as long as they serve his purpose. When they turn from him to worship other gods, he lets them. United States of Americans mouthing platitudes about freedom have obscured the meaning of America. Men came here in the first place not to be free to do what they want, but to be free to do what they ought. There is an important difference. Their leader was God. They sought first the kingdom of heaven. They prayed, "Thy kingdom come." Not freedom for me, but "Thy will be done on earth." They bound themselves to his will. That's when all the rest of this was added unto them. That's when our little fraction of this planet's population came to possess more than half of all the world's good things. Then we came along. We demanded to be free. Well, we're free. We're As free as a drifting balloon, as free as a driverless car, as free as a train without a track. We have no idea where we're going, but we're free. The day we turned from him to worship idols, that day we were set upon by truce breakers and troublemakers and cirrhosis of the liver. America is not a way of worship. America is a place of worship. Americans, when they were obedient to the laws of God, led this world. Now look who's leading. Lacking any dynamic purpose, we are being outdistanced by heathen hordes who have nothing but purpose. We have the strongest guns, they have the strongest goals. In a lifetime, a third of the world has been conquered because what we have in our hands is no match for what they have in their hearts. That's why I'm not sure the United States will survive. It could. It could, but it would have to get back on the track. I mean, we would individually and collectively have to turn aside from compromise and stop expecting laws piled on laws are going to provide salvation by legislation and revert to obedience to the basic ten. I mean, every God-fearing patriot would have to, really, fear God again. Stand up and be counted a powerful priesthood of the laity, men who know where they're going, men who are examples worth following because they're following an example worth following. With such men to show the way, God will again lead America, and Americans will again lead the world to new heights. But all other directions are down. Now, students of history are scared. They've read the record. Every great state has died by suicide. Each great nation enjoyed about 150 years at its zenith and then rotted away. Because they had a good government, the people prospered. And when they prospered, they got fat. And when they got fat, they got lazy. And moral and social and cultural and economic decay set in, and the nation rotted away. Well, the American Empire has enjoyed about 150 years at its zenith. And apparent symptoms indicate that we are Sodom and Gomorrah, overripe, rotten, ready to follow those other nation states into history's graveyard. Khrushchev is convinced of it. He reasons that capitalism replaced feudalism when feudalism had become corrupt and inefficient. He figures that communism is now going to replace our capitalism for the same reasons that we will have become corrupt and inefficient. And he's led some Americans to believe that we're in the last stages of decay, and if they've studied Rome's decline and fall, they're convinced of it, but worse, they feel utterly helpless to do anything about it. Well, now, wait a minute. Thus that twice in history, our British cousins were in just such a fix. They appeared headed for a collapse of principle, but twice they drew themselves back upright again. The British court reached an advanced stage of corruption under the Stuarts, but the people rebelled. When the people reached the stomach-turning point, they rebelled. And in the wild days of George IV and William IV, it appeared as though Britain were rotting out again, but the people rebelled. The people banged through the reform laws, and under Victoria, Britain went onward and upward to an unprecedented peak of power and prestige. Americans, in this year of crisis, in this hour of fear, confusion, self-doubt, what do you say? Let's let history record that the American people rebelled, that the people reached the stomach-turning point, and returned righteousness to politics, and revitalized their educational institutions, and stopped demanding wages without work, and stopped defending union goonery and artistic fakery, and began again to call a bomb a bomb, and junk junk, and dirt dirt, and sin sin, and starting in this unrepeatable year of our Lord, Americans, uncompromising, unafraid, uncommon Americans, standing on their toes, reaching for the stars, went on to such heights as no people on earth have ever known before.